Tef stumbled to his feet and was halfway through relieving himself against some empty boxes before he realized what he was doing. There were no high storms in here to wash the place out. Besides, he wasn't some drunkard who wallowed in filth and pissed in alleys. Was he? That thought immediately reminded him of the deeper pain. A pain beyond the pounding in his head or the ache in his bones. The pain that was with him always, like a persistent ringing, cutting deep to his core. This pain had awakened him. The pain of need. No, he wasn't just some drunkard. He was far, far worse.
Heroes of presents The Storm Pod, a Stormlight Archive podcast. Book 3, Oathbringer.
This is just a quick spoiler warning for chapters 41, 42, and 43. You betcha. We're doing three chapters today. So fun, these three chapters. Jack's finally going to get to find out what's going on with Teft. We finally get reunited with Lyft. And we find out what our forsworn Bridgman Moash is up to. I'm really excited for these chapters for Jack. They're just really cool that they all kind of ended up getting grouped together like this. So anyways, I hope that you are all caught up on your reading and that you are making sure that you've picked the right episode and that you are making sure that you enjoy the episode. Welcome to the show. I'm your host, Sean Q, and I decided a long time ago that I couldn't trust him on account of his very nice butt. It's Jack. What's up?
How are you doing today?
I mean, I'm doing better than Dalinar feels at that moment, I think, because he's all like, what? My butt?
What? Well, it's what an amazing sort of triple threat here of chapters,
isn't
that
it?
You chose. It's so great.
It's all it just happens this way that these three chapters get grouped together because they're smallish, so they can all fit in an episode. Yeah. But it's like three characters that you've longed for and wanted to know about.
Yes,
for a while now,
for a long time.
Yeah.
So Teft, Lyft, and Moash.
Yeah, dude.
So
the
wow.
return of Moash
hat trick. Yeah, this is amazing.
Yeah.
But the butts thing, it took me, like, I was like, huh? But then again, Lyft is kind of, she's just this quirky little character that would notice something like that.
Yeah.
And bring it up, and it's kind of strange, little awkward, little out of place, and it threw Dalinar off, which I liked.
And he's like, my butt.
What? My butt?
I got a nice butt.
Yeah, your butt's basically too firm, Dalinar.
Yeah, it's just.
That's the deal. you're an old guy with a firm butt, not to be trusted.
Like,
sorry,
you
spent too much time.
Dalinar must be walking around with like a Tom Holland ass. Like his just, it's round and firm. He's like a dancer's ass or something. You know what I mean?
It's a dancer's. He's a private dancer.
He's got a nice butt. Did you like these chapters? Like, are they?
You know what? Out of the three.
Mm-hmm.
If I had to choose,
mm-hmm.
my least favorite, though, is the first one.
You know, it's funny.
I don't know if I'm all that plussed, if you will, mm-hmm. about what we get about Teft.
Right.
I certainly want more.
Mm-hmm.
So it was not necessarily a disappointment, just it was, I think we sort of had hinted that it was coming, this kind of revelation about the character, mm-hmm. about
every time there was a POV of Bridge 4, they talked about him, right? Like, where's Teft?
Yeah.
They seemed to know, but we didn't.
We didn't know. Yeah.
Just a little bit of context here. This thing with Teft with fire moss has been happening for a while.
It has.
There's a chapter in Words of Radiance when Shallan and Tin are in a tent on their way to the Shattered Plains. And Tin is using fire moss. It's the first time we ever see it. She takes this stuff and she crushes it between her fingers and then gets a little bit high. The very next chapter, that happens. The very next chapter, Kaladin's like, where's Teft? Why is he late?
Right.
And there was like, it's a major foreshadowing that Sanderson brings up fire moss. The very next chapter is, where's Teft? Why is he late?
Right.
And then that's the chapter when Teft shows up and says, you know, you picked the wrong man. You know, I never wanted this kind of thing. Right.
No.
I'm not the kind of guy you can trust in. So he was telling us back then that Teft had an addiction problem.
Yeah.
So,
You know what? I don't know. Maybe just in terms of speaking about it now, maybe it is good enough that what's up with Teft has been addiction.
Mm-hmm.
So it seemed to me like it wasn't enough for me when I was reading it.
Yeah.
I wanted there to be something else in his past.
Something more complicated.
I wanted to know some other secret.
I think his addiction is because of his past.
Of course.
We have to remember that he betrayed his whole family, this whole group of this occult, you know, that he was part of. Well, you know, it wasn't just his parents, but all these people were probably his family.
Yeah.
And he betrayed them and they all died.
Yeah.
And then he's, you know, that's tough to get over.
Yeah. Well, because of that, he fits perfectly with the broken ones that Kaladin is trying to save or reshape, resculpt.
The funny thing is that Kaladin has done a really great job with all these men, but Teft has not been able to leave this part of him behind.
No.
I think he says it in the chapter. We'll get there in a bit, but he says, you know, it was easy when you were a slave and you had no money and you didn't have access to it. And then once they got promoted and they were heroes and he had spheres in his pocket, well, it was easy for him to get it.
It was easy, yeah.
Yeah. I feel like crazy. this is a level down from the Wretch. Like this, you know, the way that Teft thinks about himself and how he deems himself unworthy of anything.
Yeah.
It's very Wretch-like. It's very Kaladin-like. And
it's strange because the Wretch, Kaladin was at the precipice. He was at the line.
Yeah, it's like severe depression.
Do I throw myself over or do I carry on? With Teft, it's there is no line. It's that I am going to continue living and making it worse for myself.
Mm-hmm. There's definitely some self-worth stuff going on with Teft. I mean, can't wait to dig into it, dude. It's just one of the reasons why I love doing this is, you know, being able to read a chapter and then think about it is different. But then getting to reread it with someone live, like, when do you get to do that? Yeah, when do you get to sit down and read a book with somebody?
On the Storm Pod.
On the Storm Pod, yeah.
Okay, well, another little thing to notice between these three chapters, 41 to 43, if you look at the circular depiction of the patch, it's present here.
Yep.
It's absent for the Moash chapter, but not only that, but the ring around is broken.
Yeah, you're right. It is.
Interesting.
It's very cool, right?
It's cool.
It's a nice little detail.
It is. And so I'm glad that the...
Well, he actually rips it off in that chapter, I think, right?
I know.
Man, I can't wait to get to the Moash one, too.
Dude, he can't throw it away.
No.
No.
It's so good, dude.
It's so good.
Yeah.
Okay, so chapter 41, On the Ground, Looking Up.
Mm-hmm.
This is our Teft chapter. It begins with, regardless, this is not your concern. You turned your back on divinity. If Raze becomes an issue, he will be dealt with, and so will you.
Hmm.
Oh. So these entities feel like they're in a position, or this entity who's speaking feels like it's in a position that it can deal with Raze and
the person they're writing to.
Right.
And it sounds like the person this writer is writing to, which we know that name is Svendarius, is the name of the person who's receiving the letter.
Right.
It sounds like you turned your back on divinity.
Right.
And remember there was a...
On becoming divine? Or on association with divinity?
There was one a couple of chapters ago that had to do with shards. Do you remember this?
Yes. Yep.
No good can come of two shards settling in one location. It was agreed that we would not interfere with one another, and it disappoints me that so few of the shards have kept this original agreement.
Right.
So, I don't know. Something's building in this letter here. A little more understanding of something more cosmic.
Right.
So, it's interesting. And this Ray's character comes back here again, so.
Right. Well, the chapter begins with Teft woke up, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
So right there. Right just off those the bat. Few words says so much.
Yeah.
Doesn't want to be awake.
No, he doesn't.
Won't throw himself into the chasm.
Yeah.
So not like the wretch decision. See, this is what's interesting about Teft. Is he's not ready to throw himself over the edge. But he is willing to go through, well, I guess as an addict, how much will is there?
Right.
How much will do you actually, are you actually able to harness?
Right. He probably doesn't even feel like he's got a choice.
Right. Right. It's, yeah, you're right. The will to jump, he doesn't have that.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have to continue abusing.
Yeah, and this fire moss sounds like a nasty one too. Like we're gonna get to it here. It sounds nasty.
His first sensation was pain. It was old and familiar pain. The throbbing behind his eyes, the raw biting needles of his buried fingers, the stiffness of a body that had outlived its usefulness. Wow. Mm-hmm. Harsh.
Yeah.
The way he describes himself, outlived his usefulness. Kelek's breath. Had he ever being useful? Wow. Pretty low, Teft. He's pretty low. He rolled over, groaning.
This is the man that Teft is.
Yeah.
The Teft that was the bridgeman in that bridge crew is not the Teft who is. Do you know what I mean?
Right, right.
That's why he said, you don't want me for this job. Have I ever been useful? Well, I was when I was sober, but that's not me. Sober Teft is not Teft.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, something, yeah. Kaladin obviously is trying to show these men something other.
Mm-hmm.
That they can be something other.
Yeah.
He does not have a coat, no coat, only a tight undershirt soiled from lying on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
He was in an alleyway between tents and the breakaway market. The high ceiling vanished into the darkness. From just beyond the alleyway came the bright sounds of people chatting and haggling. He stumbles to his feet and was halfway through relieving himself against some empty boxes before he realized what he was doing. There were no high storms in here to wash the place out. Besides, he wasn't some drunkard who wallowed in filth and pissed in alleys, was he? Well, I guess... You know how they say you are what you eat?
You are what you piss?
You are what you do.
Right. For sure you are.
So if he's this drunkard wallowing in filth and pissing in alleyways, well, that's exactly what you're doing. So
yeah. But he's about to make a comment that he's actually worse than that.
That thought immediately reminded him of the deeper pain. A pain beyond the pounding in his head or the ache of his bones. The pain that was with him always, like a persistent ringing, cutting deep to his core. This pain had awakened him. The pain of need. No, he wasn't just some drunkard. He was far, far worse.
Mm-hmm.
He stumbled out of the alleyway, trying to smooth his hair and beard. Women he passed held safe hands to mouths and noses, looking away as if embarrassed for him. Mm. Perhaps it was a good thing he'd lost his coat. Storms help him if anyone recognized who he was. He'd shame the entire crew. You're already ashamed of the crew, Teft, and you know it. He thought, you're a godless waste of spit. He eventually found his way to the well, where he slouched in a line behind some others. Once at the water, he fell down on his knees and then used a trembling hand to fish out a drink with his tin cup. Once he tasted the cool water, his stomach immediately cramped, rejecting it, even though he was parched. This always happened after a night on the moss. Which I thought was a great title, too.
Night on the Moss?
A Night on the Moss, yeah.
Yeah, it sounds so nice, eh? Just a night on the moss. Like, right. You know, you're like laying on this moss under the stars or something, but yeah. It's actually not.
So he knew to ride the nausea and the cramps, hoping he could keep the water down. He slumped, holding his stomach, frightening the people in line behind him. Out in the crowd, there was always at least a small crowd near the well, and some men in uniforms shoved through. Forest Green, Sadius's men.
Mm-hmm.
They ignored the lines and then filled their buckets. When a man in Colin Blue objected, Sadius's soldiers got right up in his face. The Colin soldier finally backed down. Good lad, Teft thought. They didn't need another brawl, starting between Sadius's men and other soldiers. Teft dipped his cup again. Interesting there, though, that he observes that and says, good lad.
Mm-hmm. Like to the colon soldier.
We don't need this tension. See, that's I think that's a small hint of who he really is.
Yeah.
He cared enough to notice and to care that it's not good to have the men fighting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The sergeant, Teft, is still in there.
Sure.
Yeah.
It's just compromised with the moss.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, Teft dipped his cup again. The pain from the previous sip fading, this well seemed deep, rippling water on top and a deep blackness below. He almost threw himself in. If he woke up in damnation tomorrow, would he still feel that itching need inside? That would be a fitting torment. Voidbringers wouldn't even have to flay his soul. All they'd need to do was tell him he'd never feel sated again, and then they could watch him squirm.
Huh.
It's so brutal.
Yeah.
It must be crazy to be at the beck and call of a substance.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
It must be really
like that torturous.
I don't think I can really appreciate.
I mean, it could be. I smoke pot, but like, I can go days without smoking pot and not feel this ache and this need inside. This is different. This is something that has gotten its claws into him. You know that metaphor that they say about addiction, that monkey on your back, that thing that just sticks to you. It's like in his bones, you know? It's so deep.
Yeah.
Sanderson does a really good job of making us feel it.
Reflected in the waters on the well, a face appeared over his shoulder. It was a woman with white, pale skin, glowing faintly, and hair that hovered around her head like clouds. You leave me alone, he said, slapping his hand into the water. You just go find someone else who cares. He stumbled back to his feet, finally getting out of the way so someone else could take a spot. What hour was it? Those women with buckets were ready to draw water for the day. The drunken nighttime crowds had been replaced by the enterprising and industrious. He'd been out all night again. Kellek, he exclaims.
So can we go back here, Step, and talk about this?
Talk about this first vision here?
Yeah. What is this, do you think?
I think it's a spren. That's my guess.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Well, we know that Bridge 4 is being watched by Spren because they're close to being...
Right.
Like some of these men on the plateau were really close to saying some more words and then have their own Spren. Remember, they were like Sigzil and Cal said, what happens when the men start bonding their own Spren and not just be your squires?
Right.
So this this lady...
I know.
A woman with pale white skin, glowing faintly, and hair that covered around her head like clouds. Sounds a little bit like Syl.
It does.
You know?
Yeah.
He's like being stalked by a Spren.
I know. It's, I love it. I think it's great. And I love that he splashes the water and he's like, find someone else who cares.
Yeah.
No, it's great. Of course, I want him to turn the leaf, so to speak.
And... It's interesting because he's telling her to go away. You know, it's yep. it reminds yep. me of this, you know, the whole trope that you see on TV with the dog. Like, get out of here. Like, I don't want right. this dog. I want this dog to be protected. So I'm going to just yell at the dog and tell it to go away.
Tell it to go. But the dog doesn't give up. Right?
But the dog won't because it loves you and you are worthy of love. And like this emotes the same thing to me. Like the Spren is yeah. still this. I'm going to say Spren in quotes because we're not sure yet. But I think your read on it is pretty accurate.
Right.
And he doesn't think he's worthy. But clearly the Spren... If it's a Spren like Syl, yeah. an honor Spren thinks he's worthy.
Right.
So it's really cool. There's this really cool thing going on here.
No, I love it. I want to see more of it. Returning to the barracks would be the smart thing to do, he thought. He could, but he couldn't face them like this. He wandered through the market instead, eyes down. I'm getting worse, he thinks. A piece of him realized, the first month in Dalinar's employ. Oh, yeah, I like that. I'm getting worse, a piece of him realized.
Yeah.
Indicating that he's shattered and broken mm-hmm. into pieces.
Yeah, a piece of him, yeah.
Yeah. The first month in Dalinar's employ, he'd been able to resist for the most part, but he'd had money again after so long as a bridgeman. Having money was dangerous. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all think, oh, it'd be great to have money to begin pay for this and yeah. do that. And for him, it's dangerous.
For sure.
Having money facilitates the moss.
Well, that's what I was just saying, right? When right. he was a slave in the bridge cruise, it was easy not to be get high. He couldn't get high.
Right. Because you've got no money.
Right.
So for him, earning is problematic.
So I wonder if the entire time Kaladin is doing the things he's doing and yeah. they're getting better. I wonder if there's a part of Teft is like, no, let's please not do this. I'm me. Like I'm this sober me right now.
Right.
I'm living a horrible existence, but at least I'm not that other Teft.
Right.
You know what I mean? And like this reward, you know, Dalinar gives up his shard blade in order to free the bridgeman is an amazing thing, but maybe not for Teft. Like maybe he's maybe the only not. One that's like, well, fuck.
Yeah. Because he knows what he's going to do with this newfound freedom.
Yeah. It's really interesting to think back on what we've experienced yeah. and like.
Yeah. I almost wish, though, that Kaladin... So if Kaladin knows about the addiction,
mm-hmm.
then Kaladin should be trying to create a different experience for Teft within the organization, if you will.
Maybe they don't know how bad it is. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Okay, so he'd been able to resist for the most part, but he'd had money again, and it was dangerous. He'd functioned only mossing an evening here or an evening there. But then Kaladin had left. And this tower, where everything had felt so wrong, those monsters of darkness, including one that had looked just like Teft. He'd needed the moss to deal with that. Who wouldn't?
Mm-hmm.
He sighed. And when he looked up, he found that Spren, standing in front of him.
So wow. first off, he's talking about Ray Shafir in the right. bowels of Urithiru and seeing a dark version of himself.
Of himself, yeah.
Which he probably feels like he is the dark version of himself.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Which is kind of messed
up. It reinforced what he already thought.
Yeah, whereas all the other bridgemen were seeing a dark version of himself. He was seeing a mirror. Like right. he was looking in a mirror, like that is right. me kind of thing.
That is me. Right. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. So yeah. that's really interesting.
He'd needed the moss to deal with that Who wouldn't? He sighed, then he looked up, found that the Spren was standing in front of him. I love this, that she just, like, appears.
She's, like, not leaving him alone. I love it.
Like a ghost. She just, yeah. like, turn around, and there she is. Yeah. I love this.
It's kind of spooky if it wasn't also kind of sweet. Oh, yeah. You know what I mean?
Like, it is spooky, but it's, but I like your analogy to the dog coming back. It's, yeah, I'm liking imagining this figure. The figure that I'm thinking of is there's a I believe a magic user in Willow, in the original Willow, mm-hmm. that gives Willow her wand, and she appears as a vision, glowing,
yeah.
you know, pale yeah. pale skin, glowing mm-hmm. like flowing white hair that's kind of suspended. I'm kind of imagining that a little bit here, just not maybe as grand as the image was for Willow.
Mm-hmm.
Foolish, stupid oaths, he thinks, spoken. No, he says, no, she says, Teft, you've spoken oaths.
Right.
And he says, foolish, stupid oaths, spoken when he'd hoped that being radiant would remove the cravings. He turned away from her and found his way to a tent nestled among the taverns. Those were closed for the morning, but this place, it had no name and didn't need one. It was open. It was always open.
Mm-hmm.
Just like the ones back in Dalinar's war camp had been. Just like the ones in Sadeus's war camp. They were harder to find in some places than others, but they were always there, nameless, but still known.
Mm-hmm.
The tough-looking Herdazian man sitting at the front waved him in. It was dim inside, but Teft found his way to a table and slumped down. A woman in tight clothing and a glove with no fingers brought him a little bowl of fire moss. They didn't ask for payment. That's funny. They all knew that he wouldn't have any spheres on him today, not after his binge last night. But they would make sure to get paid eventually.
Mm-hmm.
Teft stared at the little bowl, loathing himself. And yet the scent of it made his longing multiply tenfold. He let out a whimpering groan, then seized the fire moss and ground it between his thumb and forefinger. The moss let off a small plume of smoke, and in the dim light, the center of the moss glowed like an ember. It hurt, of course. He'd worn through his calluses last night and now rubbed the moss with raw, blistered fingers. But this was a sharp, present pain, a good kind of pain, merely physical. It was a sign of life. It took a minute before he felt the effects, a washing away of his pain, followed by a strengthening of his resolve. He could remember long ago that the fire moss had done more to him. He remembered euphoria, nights spent in a dizzy, wandering daze where everything around him seemed to make sense.
Mm-hmm.
These days he needed the moss to feel normal. Like a man scrambling up wet rocks. He could barely reach where everyone else was standing before he slowly started sliding back down. It wasn't euphoria he craved anymore. It was a mere capacity to keep on going.
Yeah, so that those wow. initial, like,
crazy,
those initial good feeling highs that he gets off this are all gone now.
Yeah.
Now he's just yeah. trying to get rid of the pain of need.
Right. Yeah, it's crazy. The moss washed away his burdens, memories of that dark version of himself. Okay, the moss washed that away. Hmm. And here's our theme again, right?
Mm-hmm.
Bearing memories.
Mm-hmm.
Memories of that dark version, memories of turning his family in as heretics, even though they'd been right all along.
They had in kind of a roundabout way, been right. Now,
right.
killing themselves wasn't going to bring on their powers.
No.
But they were right that the Radiance could come back.
That's true. He was a wretch and a coward and didn't deserve to wear the symbol of Bridge 4. He'd as good as betrayed that Spren already. She'd best have fled.
That's my alternate title for the chapter.
What?
A wretch and a coward.
A wretch and a coward?
Because we yeah. always talk about the wretch so much, right? Like, it yeah. just, it's awesome that it's right there in the actual, right there in the words.
For a moment, he could give that all up to the fire moss. But unfortunately, there was something broken in Teft. Long ago, he'd gone to the moss at the urgings of other men in his squad, in Sadius's army. They could rub the stuff and get some benefit, like a man chewed ridge bark when on guard duty to stay awake. A little fire moss, a little relaxation, and then they moved on with their lives. But Teft didn't work that way. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I like that too, that with Teft, it's different.
Yeah.
For some, like as you were saying, with regards to smoking pot or when you and I occasionally enjoy a cigarette, I can enjoy something like that and put it down.
Right.
But others can't.
Right. I mean, that's why I always say I'm only allowed to have cigarettes at the cottage once a year, right? Because if not, then I'd be smoking all the time.
Right.
Hmm.
Yeah. But for Teft, but Teft didn't work that way.
No.
See, for us, it's different.
But for Teft, I think the fire moss for some people allows them to have a relaxing evening once in a while.
Yeah.
But for Teft, it allows him to, what did that say? To wash away his burdens.
Right. He's using it for different reasons.
Right.
Rather than having a night of relaxation,
he's escaping.
He's using it. Right.
Right.
Burdens shoved aside, he could have gotten up and gone back to the Bridgeman. He could have started his day. But Storm's a few more minutes sounded so nice, and he kept going. He went through three bowls before a garish light made him blink. He pulled his face off the table where, to his shame, he drooled up a puddle. How long had it been, and what was that terrible, awful light? "Here he is," Kaladin's voice said as Teft blinked. A figure knelt beside the table. Oh, Teft.
So, I read this, so it's so great. The terrible, awful light is clearly the doorway to the tent being opened. Right?
Yes.
It's a drug den, so it's dark.
Yeah,
it's and dark. Teft and Teft is like, you know, he doesn't want to see the light. So the light, but I think also the light is Kaladin.
For sure.
What's that terrible, awful light?
Awful light, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I just...
Yeah.
There's a metaphor there that, like, this fucking guy wants me to be better than I am, and I've told him I'm not worthy of it.
Right.
And here he is again, fucking with his light.
Keeps coming around.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, again, it's like the dog. Like, you know, it's a character that won't give up on him, and it's not just Kaladin.
Mm.
It's this Spren.
Yeah, because Rock's here with him too.
Yeah. And I was just about to say, it's also the men.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
"Here he is," Kaladin's voice says as Teft blinked. A figure knelt beside the table. "Oh, Teft, he owes us for three bowls," said the den's keeper. "One garnet brome." "Be glad," an accented voice growled. "We do not rip off pieces of your body and pay you with those." That's funny.
Yeah.
"Storm's Rock was here too," Teft groaned, turning away. "Don't see me," he croaked. "Don't. Our establishment is perfectly legal, Horneater," the den keeper said. "If you assault us, be assured we will bring the guard and they will defend us." Ooh, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. It's not illegal.
The guard will defend these drug dens.
Mm-hmm.
"Here's your blood money, you eel," Kaladin says, pushing the light toward them. "Rock, can you get him?" Large hands took Teft, surprisingly gentle with their touch. He was crying. "Kellek." "Where's your coat, Teft?" Kaladin asked from the darkness. "I sold it," Teft admitted, squeezing his eyes shut against the shame spren that drifted down around him in the shape of flower petals. "I sold my own storming coat." Kaladin fell silent, and Teft let Rock carry him from the den. Halfway back, he finally managed to scrounge up enough dignity to complain about Rock's breath and make them let him walk on his own feet with a little support under the arms.
Whoa. Yeah, dude. Shame
Spren. It's hard to see him in this state.
Yeah.
Yeah, shame Spren, and
he's crying a little.
Yeah, it's awful.
Mm-hmm.
It's not quite what I had imagined, but I am interested to see what role you know, addiction has to play.
Well, it's great because we have all this stuff that we're dealing with in the series.
Mm-hmm.
And addiction is something us, you know, like the regular human beings in this world can understand a little easier. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
Not everyone can understand depression. Not everyone can understand what Shallan's going through with her trauma and potential, like multiple personality disorder or a DID. But like, you know, most of us have had someone in our lives who have, you know, suffered through addiction. And it's something that we've been more exposed to through, you know, pop culture and you know, TV movies and all that stuff.
Sure.
So it's something a little more familiar in this like fantastic world. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, and the pain is raw. Mm-hmm. Like it's, and again, when you're kind of, this story is like, it's about seeing the potential in the characters.
Mm-hmm.
So you get used to as a reader, oh, come on, Tef, you can do better than this.
Right.
And then to see him, you know, drooling on a table, you know, getting into debt for his drugs.
Yeah.
Like it's a very dark side of
like
Tef.
What's it gonna take for him? You know what I mean?
You know, like, that's what I'm wondering is that, like, I'm wondering if the story, like, trajectory for him is, you know, whether he conquers it at all.
Right.
Like, he may have to, like, it's kind of like what you said before with regards to all the good men are gone.
All you have is us, yeah.
All you have is us. It's like, you know what? Yes, I'm an addict. And that's going to have to be enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting.
We'll,
yeah.
We'll see. We'll see what happens. Teft, so there's a POV change here, or scene change. Teft envied better men than he. They didn't have the itch, the one that went so deep that it stung his soul. It was persistent, and it was always with him, and couldn't ever be scratched, despite how hard he tried. Kaladin and Rock set him up in one of the barrack rooms, private, wrapped in blankets with a bowl of Rock's stew in his hands. Teft made the proper noises, the ones they expected.
Mm-hmm.
Apologies, promises he would tell them if he was feeling the need again, promises that he'd let them help him, though he couldn't eat the stew, not yet. It would be another day before he could keep anything down. Storms, but they were good men. Better friends than he deserved. They were all growing up, they were all growing into something grand, while Teft just stayed on the ground, looking up. There's our
title. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting because stayed on the ground looking up because they're about to fly.
Right.
Right? And he's grounded.
Mm-hmm. Literally.
Yeah.
With a pool of drool.
They left him to get some rest. And he stared at the stew, smelling the familiar scent, not daring to eat it. He'd go back to work before the day was out, training bridgemen from the other crews. He could function. He could go for days, pretending is the key word there. Pretending that he was normal. He'd balanced everything in Sadius's army for years before taking one step too far, missing duty one too many times, and landing himself in the bridge crews as punishment.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, so there a little you go. Bit
of, yeah, his immediate past here.
So he was put into bridge crew duty because he messed up in Sadius's army.
Mm-hmm.
Those months running bridges had been the only time in his adult life when he hadn't been dominated by the Moss. But even back then, when he'd been able to afford a little alcohol, he'd known that eventually he'd find his way back. The liquor wasn't ever enough. Even as he braced himself to go to work for the day, one nagging thought overshadowed his mind, a shameful thought. I'm not going to get any more moss for a while, am I? That sinister knowledge hurt him more than anything. He was going to have to go a few excruciating days, feeling like half a man. Days when he couldn't feel anything but his own self-loathing. Days living with the shame and the memories, the glances of other bridgemen. Days without any storming help whatsoever, and that terrified him.
Mm-hmm.
That's our chapter.
I got like a strong, Stone Temple Pilots Scott Whelan vibe from this end of this chapter here when he says he was going to have to go a few excruciating days feeling like half a man.
Half a man.
Yeah. I'm half the man I used to be.
Right.
It's interesting because Scott Whelan famously dealt with addiction his whole life.
Whole life.
So it's very, very interesting that, that line is in there. I'm not saying that Sanderson took it from that song, but I feel like there's a theme there that you really do feel like not yourself, not your whole self, right? Because what he's saying is he's going to feel like half a man while he's not on the moss.
Right.
Not that he feels half a man because of the moss. He's feeling half a man when he's not on it.
Right.
Which is a hard thing to wrestle with, right?
Well, the moss has really taken over. And I really like, first of all, I think it's really creative. Just the whole idea of fire moss.
Mm-hmm.
I really like this thing.
It's a really neat drug.
It's a really neat drug, but just even word-wise, it's a great choice. Moss is something that grows when things are left alone.
Mm-hmm.
And if Teft can keep moving, then the moss can't grow.
Right.
But it's when he slows down and he's left to his depression and his shame and he's in a dark, dim room, that's where the moss can get you. Caledon wants him to keep moving. Let's go, Sergeant.
You have stuff to do. Yeah.
If you keep moving, the moss is not going to grow.
Moving forward along your oath track of becoming a Radiant. Yeah. He doesn't.
Right.
Yeah.
Keep moving. But what I'm curious about, so just word wise, I think it's a great choice, very creative and very clever. And it speaks to a lot of neat little things there. But what I'm most curious about with Teft now is how will addiction become a potentially necessary component to the battles and the struggles ahead.
Right.
Like, can someone with addiction be exactly what's required?
Or will,
you know what I mean,
his addiction cost him and his men?
Or will it have a negative, horrible effect? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it could go that way too. I'm hoping that with these broken, just with the theme of having so-called broken brick character. I mean, at this point, I would say that we're not necessarily looking at them now as broken characters. It's hard to wrestle with the Blackthorn, but I love that he's trying.
Mm-hmm.
I love that all of these characters, well, maybe in Teft's case here, he could try a little more.
Well, that's what Cal says about Elokar in Words of Radiance. At least he's trying.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
What's your highlight for this little chapter here?
I like it that he noticed the men.
Mm-hmm.
And he points that good out lad. And says, no, they good lad. So good lad was a good thing for me because that was him.
Yeah.
That's the sergeant. That's the responsible soldier. That's the Teft
we knew about before this chapter.
It's the Teft that exists. The moss has changed things. And the way that he viewed, I guess, his family's beliefs with regards to the Radiance, you know, he was wrong about that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing that can change that.
It's funny, eh? Because, like, he says in here, he spent most of his adult life on moss.
Yeah.
So like, that is Teft.
Yeah. It's so much a part of him.
And the Teft who's not on the moss is a completely different person to him. Like, we talk about these, like, you know, the diplomat versus the Blackthorn and the surgeon versus the soldier and the scholar versus the sneak, like all these like kind of dual representations in these characters. And the addict is Teft. Sergeant Teft is this other thing he wore for a while, but that's not him. It's really, really interesting.
It's his other form.
Yeah, it is. It is his other form. My My highlight is that yours? Teft has a Spren following him. Obviously, it's amazing.
Yeah. It's so cool.
But it makes me feel like, you know, in that chapter that we had when Rock was making the stew and he saw that there were all these Spren that were kind of like waiting in the wings to see if men would take to it and if anyone would be viable to become a Radiant themselves and have one of these Spren bonded to him.
Right.
That is different than this. Those Spren were like kind of hanging out, waiting in the wings, watching.
Waiting in the wings.
This one is following Teft around saying, you have spoken oaths. I think this means that Teft has spoken more than just life before death, the first one. I think it means he might have spoken the second oath as well.
I think you're probably right about that.
Like that,
I hadn't really put that together.
His relationship with this Spren seems farther along than those men on the plateau with the Spren that were watching him.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
you know what I mean? So
yeah,
I'm not. There's no evidence of that.
And she did say oaths, like plural.
Yeah, she did, didn't she? Hold on. Yeah. Let's find that little clip again. Yeah.
I'm pretty sure
you've spoken oaths, plural. Yeah.
Not the first oath. Yeah.
So yeah, that's interesting to think about that.
I like it that she's there. I like it that Kaladin's there. Mm-hmm. I kind of consider them all to be one. Like this light that he actually that's another great highlight moment is that he's cursing the light, you know, the way he described it, the awful, terrible light.
Yeah, and it's Kaladin.
That's a great way to describe like from an addict's perspective, like just leave me be what I am.
Yeah.
You know, don't shed light on this dark corner of my world.
So funny.
Like this is all I have.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I don't know. I was disappointed at the level at which he was compromised by this. And like I said to you, I was hoping for just something else, either dealing with his past, family, other connections. I was hoping for something like that. But I guess the grit and realness of this chapter is it's heavy.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Yeah.
Because it's rooted in something that we understand. We know, like, shit, he's going through something really challenging right now. Before we move on to the next chapter, something I wanted to bring up. Should have brought it up at the beginning of the episode, but we got a lot of responses this week about something that we said in one of the past episodes, and I thought we would just quickly talk about it. That chapter, when the men are at the Shattered Plains again and Rock is cooking the stew, it's the Rock POV.
Yep.
And the Lopin is talking about having been a king. Remember we talked about that? And he's talking about how he had been a king before. And we were like, oh, wouldn't that be funny if his like family line was a king back 100 years ago and that's why he calls himself a king? Actually, there is a word of Brandon where Brandon clarified what that means. And because it doesn't really spoil the rest of the story for you, I'm going to tell you what he said about this. He said
what Brandon said. Okay.
He said that while Elokar was staying at Lopin's parents' house, they convinced him to abdicate the throne to Lopin for a very short amount of time so that if the guards came looking for King Elokar, they could say, there's no King Elokar here because he wasn't king any longer. It was very important for Lopin's family to not have to lie to the guards.
Oh,
and so
they
convinced Elokar to abdicate the throne for like a day to Lopin. So he was King Lopin for a day.
King for a day.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Isn't that awesome?
Is that anywhere in the text or is that just Brandon?
That's Brandon saying it after the fact at an interview or like at a convention or whatever, saying that's
fun.
Like in his headcanon, that's how it happened kind of thing.
But it's not in text.
No, but it is in text because he claims to have been a king.
True.
So it did happen. It just happened off page. And he's clarifying this is why he said he was a king before.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
That's really cool. I like
that. Isn't that interesting?
That's so much fun. Yeah, that's great. Of course, Lopin.
Yeah.
Of course he's the king.
Yeah, right?
Gosh, we love Lopin.
Yeah, he's awesome.
My God. Okay, so chapter 42 is Consequences.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon me. This is an interesting chapter.
It is, because it's not a lift chapter. Because it doesn't start off like that. It's a completely, Yeah.
It has a lift. It has a lift at the end.
Definitely lifts you up. Yeah.
It lifts at the end. Chapter 42, and the number, the answer to everything. So the answer to everything is consequences.
Right.
We get a name here. Sephandrius, the bearer of the first gem. You must know better than to approach us by relying upon presumption of past relationship.
Mm-hmm. So we know Fisandrius is the guy who's receiving this letter, the person who's receiving this letter.
Right.
And it said just in the last one, you turned your back on divinity.
On divinity, yeah.
And they're calling him the bearer of the first gem.
Right.
There's all kinds of stuff swirling around in this letter here that isn't necessarily making sense, but it's kind of creating like a narrative that
is
we...
Is this like the splintering? Is the shard... Are the shards capitalized?
Mm-hmm.
Is it like a splintering of gods that then go out into a cosmic area to then be, you know, to be divine sparks for different realms or something like that?
I mean, yeah, maybe. That sounds amazing.
Is that what it is?
I mean, that sounds awesome.
So you could have like the one, this almighty, and then there's a splintering because the necessity for divine presence throughout a galaxy or universe or something like that.
Like a Cosmere?
Like a Cosmere. Because the word Cosmere, which I don't really technically know what it means, but it sounds, with that word, sorry, I must apologize. To everyone listening, I'm having my last bite of a muffin.
Yeah,
my
and
apologies.
Like, this I literally just noticed that you're eating through talking.
I'm terrible.
You know, I'm just going to, next time we pot, I'm just bringing up a plate of spaghetti.
I'm so sorry. I'm just so hungry this morning. Okay, my apologies. I ate a last bite of a muffin. It was delicious. But... Yeah, like, so Cosmere for me, that's a word that I'm pretty sure it represents a universe.
I think you're right in there, yeah.
Or a multiverse, something mm-hmm. along those lines. So these shards, these entities, Sephandrius being one, the first gem, the shattering of the Almighty, who was it that it was the entity that went up against the Almighty?
Odium.
Maybe like an unintended consequence of Odium's. Maybe Odium caused the shattering. Maybe Odium thought that would be the end of it, but it wasn't the end. It was just the beginning.
I'll say this.
Great.
You're on to something right now.
Okay.
You've epigraphs are helping you figure it out, and you're onto something, and things will become way more clear after this book.
After this book, really?
Yeah, I think so.
Ooh,
yeah,
that's, you gave me a little hint there. That's cool.
Yeah. So,
Okay. Well, that's what we get at the beginning. And that's where I had my thought during this chapter, and I brought it up with you, which is, can the visions be used to actually change things?
Yeah, like you mean, so can they go into a vision and affect the past?
Yes.
And I said that it was more like the Harry Potter pensieve, where they are witnessing the past.
They're just witnesses, though.
But they're active participants in the past, in these visions, and the vision changes depending on what they do, but they're not traveling into the past. The past is set.
Right. But you're right. And so far, well, it could be so far that the participation that has happened, Dalinar, Yasna,
Navani,
and
Queen Fen
has gone into one. And now
Yonagon and Lyft.
Now Yonagon has gone in. So it could be that so far the participation hasn't affected all that much.
It hasn't. There's nothing.
But what I was curious about is,
yeah, go ahead.
Whether or not the Almighty was basically presenting these visions to Dalinar as a way to solve the problem. That it has to do with solving the past. Everyone seems to be trying to solve it now, dealing with the Parshendi, dealing with the Voidbringers, dealing with the different forms and the mm-hmm. relationships between all these different peoples, and trying to hash out an existence, dealing with the heralds. But maybe it's not solvable in the present. That's all I really want to bring
up. None of these visions have shown any changes to the past. Nothing that these characters have done have affected anything. Like, they haven't come out of the vision and been like, oh, the world's slightly different because I did something.
But what if they did do something that did change it? So what if there is a vision, and what if there is a participation in that vision that actually did alter something? And then when they come out of it, things would be different.
It's a very interesting thought. I don't know if Sanderson is using these visions as a vehicle to time travel and make change. I think it's more like, you know, if you don't know your past, you're doomed to repeat it. I think it's more in that type of way.
More in that vein, yeah.
But I do like the idea of this idea of affecting change in the past. I mean, I can't tell you whether or not that's true or not, because we don't have any proof that it's not true, but the visions have not shown us any indication that they are actually traveling to the past.
Right.
Like the Stormfather has told Dalinar that these were created to help the future. So
Right. Well, maybe it's just that then. These visions are like looking into an old tome of history,
mm-hmm.
and there are answers. It's almost like you're doing research,
right?
Okay. Inside the increasingly familiar vision, Dalinar knocked an arrow, released it. It was a black, fletched missile into the back of a wild man. The man's screech was lost in the cacophony of battle. So here's Dalinar right where he needs to be mm-hmm. in the battle. Dalinar methodically knocked a second arrow and then loosed it. This arrow hit as well, lodging into a man's shoulder. The man dropped his axe mid-swing, causing him to miss the young, dark-skinned youth lying on the ground. The boy was barely in his teens, and the awkwardness had not left him. His limbs were too long, his face was too round, he was too childlike. And Dalinar couldn't help but think that he would have let him run messages, but not hold a spear.
Mm-hmm.
So different times called for different measures, clearly, mm-hmm. back in the day. The lad's age hadn't prevented him from being named Prime Aquasix, Yanagon the First, ruler of Azir, emperor of Greater Makabak.
So the kid he's seeing because it's actually Gox.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
But Gox is probably in the body of a man in this war.
Right.
And for reference sake, this vision that he's brought Yanagon, Gox, in is the same vision he brought Navani and Yasna in. Right. The one that ends with all the shard blades, or the honor blades, put into the ground. It's the same one.
Dalinar had perched on some rocks. His bow was in his hand. While he didn't intend to repeat his mistake of letting Queen Fen manage all of her own in a vision, he also didn't want Yanagon to slip through it without challenge or stress. There was a reason that the Almighty had put Dalinar in danger in these visions. He'd needed a visceral understanding of what was at stake.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a comment in the next chapter or next paragraph here about Dalinar's archery. Though his archery in recent years had been with so-called shard bows, fabrial bows crafted with such a heavy draw weight that only a man in shard plate could use them.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Now, that's really cool.
Yeah, the strength that the armor gives you is what allows you to pull back on the bow.
I love it. I'm really into these shard bows.
Well, it's like in D&D, you know, you had to have, in order to have one of these like special bows, you had to have a, in the second edition, you had to have an 18 slash at least 50 to be able to pull on one or whatever.
To be able to pull it, yeah. Yeah, third edition had rules for that too, actually. No, I'm fascinated. I hope we get some more shard bows in the story. It was strange experiencing this battle for the third time, Dalinar thought. The sense of smoke and moldy, inhuman blood. The way that man below fell after losing an arm, screaming the half-prayer, half-condemnation of the Almighty. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
With Dalinar's bowmanship, the band of defenders did last against the enemy until that Radiant climbed up over the edge of the hill, glowing in shardplate. Emperor Yanagon sat down as the other soldiers rallied around the Radiant and pushed the enemy backward. The Emperor finally stumbled to his feet, using the spear like a staff. This boy was no soldier, Dalinar thought. From his experience, Asius generals were too pragmatic to want the throne. It involved too much pandering to bureaucrats and apparently dictating essays.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting that in Asian culture, so the generals that are, you know, battle-worn and battle-experienced, they couldn't care less about running it.
No.
Because of all the bureaucracy.
Yeah, because the whole thing is built on paperwork and bureaucracy that they, yeah.
So I just think that's interesting that, you know, it goes to, well, just let someone young do it.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. The youth started down a path from the cliff, and Dalinar followed. And there's that word again, Ahariatem.
Mm-hmm.
Or, sorry, Ahariatium?
Yeah, both I think are right.
The people who lived through this had thought that it was the end of the world. They'd assumed that they would return to the Tranquiline Halls. How would they respond to the information that, after four millennia, mankind still hadn't been allowed into heaven?
Mm-hmm.
What a crazy thing to be at that time. They believe it in this previous era.
Mm-hmm.
And 4,000 years had happened and still nothing had been solved.
Right.
Imagine that. Imagine that's where we are
in
our world. We are trying to make the world better. Fast forward 4,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
Not much has changed.
Not much.
It's pretty depressing.
Yeah.
Okay. The boy stopped at the bottom of the twisting path. He watched the wounded men limp by. Moans and shouts rose in the air. Dalinar intended to step up and start explaining about these visions, but the boy strode out to walk among the wounded men, chatting with them. Dalinar followed, was curious, catching fragments of the conversations. What happened here? And who are you? And why were you fighting?
Mm-hmm.
I like this with Yanagon, that he's interested in the wounded.
Yeah.
And spending time with them. The men didn't have many answers. They were wounded, exhausted, and trailed by Painspren. They did find their way to a larger group, though, in the direction Yasna had gone during Dalinar's previous visit to the vision. The crowd had gathered around a man standing on a large boulder, a tall and confident man. He was in his 30s, and he wore white and blue. He had an Alethi feel to him, except not quite. His skin was a shade darker, and something was faintly off about his features, yet there was something familiar about the man.
Hmm.
Playing a role, right? Who do you think this is?
I mean, I don't know.
I don't know.
I think it's possible.
Something familiar?
It's possible that this could be one of the heralds. And so he looks familiar because there's statues everywhere about the heralds.
Right.
In their religion, right? So
it's confirmed that it's a herald, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. It is, right? Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. You must spread the word, the man proclaimed. We have won. At long last, the Voidbringers are defeated. This is not my victory or that of the other heralds. It is your victory.
That's right.
You have done this. Some of the people shouted in triumph. Too many others stood silent, staring with dead eyes. I will lead the charge for the Tranquiline Halls, the man shouted. You will not see me again, but think not on that now. You have won your peace. Revel in it and rebuild. Go now and help your fellows. Carry with you the light of the Herald King's words. We are victorious at long last. over evil.
This is the big lie, right? This is the lie that the heralds told the people, that they had won and that it was all over.
All over, yeah. Yeah, this is not good. Mm-hmm. But what I find is interesting is just a little previous. We have won at long last. Hang on. Dalinar. Too many others stood silent. Right. Too many others stood silent. So it, what it speaks to me, and this is Dalinar noticing all of this, is it's Dalinar's trying to unite them.
Mm-hmm.
He's trying to rally people together.
Mm-hmm.
That's what this individual is doing here.
Yeah.
But not with great numbers.
No.
Too few are silent, staring with dead eyes.
Yeah, well, they've just been through a horrible battle, right?
Right. But you can't change things if you don't have people on board.
No, it's true.
If there's all this division and fragmentation, how are you going to accomplish anything?
Well, this is what Dalinar is hoping to do with these visions, is try to get these leaders on board.
Right.
So it's kind of fitting.
Another round of shouts, more energy this time. Dalinar thought, he felt a chill. This was Jezereza Ellen himself, king of herald of kings, the greatest among them.
We've called him Yezrian a bunch of times.
Yeah, Yezrian. So
remember that all the heralds have like 3 or 4 different names, right?
Right. Wait, did the king have dark eyes? The group broke up, but the young emperor remained, staring at the place where the herald had stood. Finally, he whispered, "O Yezir, king of the heralds." "Yes," Dalinar says, stepping up beside him. "That was him. Your Excellency, my niece visited this vision earlier, and she wrote that she thought she'd spotted him." Yanagon grabbed Dalinar by the arm. "What did you say? You know me?" "You are Yanagon of Azir. I am Dalinar Colan, and I apologize that our meeting must take place under such an irregular circumstance." The youth's eyes widened. "I see Yezir himself first, and now my enemy." "I am not your enemy," Dalinar sighed, "and this is no mere dream." "Your Excellency, I know it's not a dream," Yanagon said. "As I am a prime raised to the throne miraculously, the heralds may choose to speak through me." He looked about. "This day we are living through. It is the day of glory." "Ahariatayim," Dalinar says, "yes." "Why did they place you here? What does it mean?" "They didn't place me here," Dalinar says. "Your Excellency, I investigated this vision and I brought you into it." Skeptical, the boy folded his arms. He wore the leather skirt provided by the vision. He'd left his bronze-tipped spear leaning against a rock nearby.
I like this here where Gox Yanagon thinks he's the one who's been blessed with the vision.
Right.
And somehow he brought in Dalinar.
Right.
Because he's been told, because he's the prime, that he has, you know, the closest connection to all this stuff, and that the heralds can use him as a vessel for stuff. So he thinks he's the reason for all this, which is hilarious.
It's great. And him crossing his arms, and yeah. I think it's great too. What I really like is he says, "I see Yezir himself first, and now I see my enemy."
Yeah.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, he left his bronze-tipped spear leaning against a rock nearby. "Have you been told," Dalinar asked, "that I am considered mad?" "There are rumors." "Well, this was my madness. I suffered these visions during the storms. Come and see." He led Yanagon to a better view of the large field of the dead, and his face grew ashen at the sight. He strode down onto the larger battlefield, moving among the corpses, the moans, and the curses. So many dead eyes, so many faces, twisting in pain. Light-eyed and dark, pale skin like the Shin, and some Horn-Eaters. Dark skin like the Makabaki, many that could have been Alethi or Vedan or Herdazian. There were other things, of course. The giant, broken stone figures, parchmen wearing war form, with chitin armor and orange blood. One spot they passed had a whole heap of strange kremlings, burned and smoking. Who would have taken the time to pile up 1,000 little crustaceans? So I think this is another something.
I know, we know what this is.
Well, illuminate.
We met one in an alley in the book Edge Dancer.
Right.
Remember? Lift meets the guy named the Sleepless. One of the Sleepless.
One of the Sleepless, yeah.
And it's like, and he's a like whole shit ton of kremlings that are all forming together to make a person.
Right. So hang on. Wait a sec. This is a dead one?
Or it's a dead one or several dead ones. And they're burning the bodies.
Oh. Okay, wow.
And since their bodies
crazy.
Are made up of all these little, like, bibits,
all the little kremlings. It looks like a pile, but it's actually a body.
It's actually bodies.
Wow. But Sleepless.
Yeah.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
There may be a reason why they hide now, right? Like, clearly they were part of this. If, you know, they were dead on this battlefield, and maybe they decided to retreat, and whatever, whichever ones are left over, they're hiding now.
That's cool.
There are many different theories on who we've already met in the series could be a Sleepless without us realizing it.
How are they able to look like another humanoid?
I mean, they can't look like other people. They can just look like themselves, but they can blend in. And if...
How do you blend in if you're just a bunch of...
Bibits? If you're just a bunch of... Kremlings stuck together? I don't really know. But the old man that we talked to in that alley fooled us until...
Yeah, but he appeared as an old man. So how can you appear as an old man if you're comprised of a bunch of crustaceans?
Maybe the seams of where all the bibits connect aren't clear. Like, maybe they blend in way more normally.
Huh.
To look like someone, and then when they want you to see their true visage, they can kind of break apart a little more and show you that they're made up of a bunch of different little... I keep using bibits only because I know Papineau is going to be throwing a bibits. Hand up in the air. Yeah.
Okay. Lipsy bibits.
Mm-hmm.
We fought together, Yanagon said. How else could we have resisted, Dalinar asks. To fight the desolation alone would be madness. Yanagon eyed him. You wanted to talk to me without the viziers. You wanted me alone? And you can just show me whatever will strengthen your argument? If you accept that I have the power to show you these visions, would that not in itself imply that you should listen to me? The Alethi are dangerous. Do you know what happened the last time the Alethi were in Azir? Dalinar says, the Sunmaker's rule was a long time ago. The viziers have talked about this, Yanagon says. They told me all about it. It started the same way back then, with a warlord uniting the Alethi tribes. What do you think? History repeating.
Yeah, we know a little bit.
Before, we have a warlord now.
Mm-hmm. We know a little bit about this Sunmaker in that he, like Alexander the Great, kind of like united the areas around him and then... Right. Kept expanding and expanding and expanding. And so the Sunmaker really was just trying to unite the Alethi tribes and then took over Herdaz. And then, you know, Yakaved and then here and then there. And then just kept expanding and expanding and expanding. So that's what they're worried about, right?
What? They're worried about
Worried that he is the new Sunmaker.
Right, of course. Yeah. Right? Why wouldn't they think that?
Mm-hmm. Well, he just declared himself High King or whatever. Of Urithiru. Right. And he is a warmonger and he is the Blackthorn. We have to keep reminding ourselves that the Blackthorn is famous. He's infamous in this world.
Right.
Everyone knows what he's done.
Are we just being tricked the entire time?
The beauty about all this is that they know, the people who know his reputation in this world know more than us. Because Dalinar's past has not fully been revealed to us.
Right.
We are still working our way through his flashbacks.
No, but what I mean to ask you is, like, what if, like, I don't know. I can't even imagine it, but I've mentioned to you
if it
before,
turns
but,
where,
you
like, know, Dalinar's been the big bad the whole time.
Yeah.
And we've been cheering him
just
on.
Like, we've been cheering him on, and yeah. and it's just this weird way of Dalinar putting the pieces right where he wants them. But it can't be that story because he can't be using. Well, I'll say this about Yasna. Yasna seems interested in more than I would like, anyways, in terms of. What?
I just love how you definitely are always able to bring it back to the alley when she killed those dudes. Like, it's just.
No. Oh, I it's not was, just that. Okay. It's in the previous chapters, what we just covered, where yeah. she's. Speaking that she would eradicate the Parshendi
for sure,
and Kaladin is, you know, strictly against this,
no,
based
right.
on the intel.
Yeah,
that
you're
gathered.
Right. You're right. There is a little bit of that there.
Anyway, I don't know. Let's hope it doesn't go there, but we'll see. The viziers have talked about this. They told me all about it. It started the same way back then with a warlord uniting the Alethi tribes. So this kid says that the Alethi are just a tribe.
Yep.
To which Dalinar responds, tribes? You would compare us to the nomads that roam to Bela? Alethkar is one of the most cultured kingdoms on Roshar. Your code of law is barely 30 years old. Your Excellency, Dalinar says, I doubt this line of conversation will be relevant. Look around us. Look and see what the desolation will bring. He swept his hand across the awful view, and Yanagon's temper cooled. It was impossible to feel anything but sorrow when confronted with so much death.
I really love this whole, your code of law is barely 30 years old.
Yeah.
Because it's true, right? Like, Gavilar and Sadeas and Dalinar kind of, like, made this empire through conquering all these other high princes. Either politically or actually physically. And so their nation is young. I kind of compare it to when, like, European nations are like, oh, how cute. America is a couple of hundred years old.
I know.
It's so cute. Like, look at those, that so toddler. Cute. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like
little baby countries.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Well,
oh, congratulations, Canada. You turned 150 recently. Good for you. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's also kind of rich, though, when he says 30 years old. It's like, well, yeah, but you're barely 15.
Right, but he's part of a bureaucracy around for hundreds of years or whatever. Yeah, yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
I'm just saying it's interesting
coming from that
perspective.
For sure.
Like from someone so young. Okay. Eventually, Yanagon turned and started back the way that they had come, and Dalinar joined him. They'd say, Yanagon whispered, that when the Sunmaker rode out of the passes and into Azir, that he had one unexpected problem. He conquered my people too quickly and didn't know what to do with all of his captives. He couldn't leave a fighting population behind him in the towns because there were thousands upon thousands of men he needed to murder. And sometimes he'd simply assign the work to his soldiers. Every man was to kill 30 captives. Like a child who had to find an armload of firewood before being allowed to play. In other places, the Sunmaker declared something arbitrary. Say that every man with hair beyond a certain length was to be slaughtered before he was struck down with disease by the heralds. He murdered 10% of the population of Azir. They say Zophix was filled with the bones blown by high storms into piles as tall as the buildings. I am not my ancestor, Dalinar said softly. Wow. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
Yeah. It sounds horrible.
This is systemic, like, genocide.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Horrible.
And it's in keeping with what we know of the Alethi, really. Because they love war. It's part of their whole, it's baked
right.
into who they are.
Yep. Dalinar says, I am not my ancestor. You know what? I want that to be my highlight.
Mm-hmm. I am not my ancestor.
But I want it to be true.
Yeah.
That's the catch.
Right.
I am not my ancestor, but you revere him. The Alethi all but worship Setis. You carry his storming shardblade.
The Oathbringer, right? Oathbringer was the Sunmaker's blade.
Sunmaker's blade. History repeating.
Mm-hmm. It's a symbol, right? It's a symbol for who everyone thinks Dalinar is.
He says, I gave that away.
Mm-hmm.
He gave it to Sadeas, right?
Yep. Yeah. And now it's in the hands of Iole and Amaram.
Right. Sadeas' wife.
Sadeas' wife and the new High Prince Sadeas, which is Amaram. Remember, Iole was going to make him the new High Prince.
Right. Okay, they stopped at the edge of the battlefield. The Emperor had grit, but didn't know how to carry himself. He walked with his shoulders slumped and his hands were kept reaching for pockets that weren't there from his antiquated clothing. He was of low birth, though in his ear they didn't properly revere eye color. They didn't properly revere?
Mm-hmm.
That shows Dalinar's colors.
Yep, for sure.
Navani had once told him it was because there weren't enough people in Azir with light eyes. There weren't enough.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Again.
Yeah.
Those are revealing statements. Very much and Navani.
So. Yep.
The Sunmaker himself had used this to justify conquering them. I am not my ancestor, Dalinar repeated, but I do share much with him. A youth of brutality. A lifetime spent at war. I have one advantage he did not. Which is, I've lived long enough to see the consequences of what I've done. Yennagon nodded slowly. Yeah, you're old, a voice piped up. Dalinar turned, frowning. That had sounded like a young girl. Where would there be a girl on the battlefield? I didn't expect you to be so old, the girl said. She sat perched cross-legged on a large boulder nearby. And you're not really that black. They call you Blackthorn, but you're really more like Dark Tan Thorn. Gox is more black than you are, and even he's pretty brownish. The young... It's so funny. I like her.
You're Dark Tan Thorn.
You're like more like Dark Tan Thorn.
Oh my god, it's so funny.
That's got... You know what? I think it's left is the highlight.
Highlight. Come on.
Yeah, come on. The young emperor remarkably burst into an enormous grin. Lift, you're back! He started climbing up the boulder, heedless of decorum. Not quite back, she said. Got sidetracked, but I'm close now. What happened in Yadaw? Yennagon said, eager. You barely gave me any kind of explanation. Those people lie about their food. She narrowed her eyes at Dalinar as the young emperor slipped down the boulder, then tried to climb up another side. This is not possible, the Stormfather said in Dalinar's mind. How did she come here? This is an interesting development.
Yeah, okay, a couple of things here. Lift, you're back. It's the first time Gox and Lift see each other since Edge Dancer.
Right.
Okay.
She was going to head back and try to find him, right?
And this is her finding him right now.
Right. Which is interesting. Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, it's interesting that because she would have gone back to where she had found him at the, remember that place all in bronze?
Yeah, the main city of Azir.
Yeah, right. So I'm assuming she would have gone there.
Yeah, and she says she's like, not quite back, got sidetracked, but I'm close. Meaning she's getting close to where he is. Maybe she's in the city. You know what I mean? Like she's getting close.
So what I had envisioned was that maybe she, you know, was able to get in because her and Windle seem to be pretty, they've already broken in before.
Taking so it they can in do everything, it again. Yeah.
Right. So because she's slick like that, she could be right beside him and then like seeing his body in this dream.
Mm-hmm.
And then she thinks, and then she, obviously she has the power to know, oh, he's there.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go there.
It's that's possible too. You know, that's very possible.
But you're right. Like if she's close, then you're right. Like if she's close, meaning not right beside him as he's experiencing this vision, What that could mean is just in proximity, like when she gets into the city, she can feel that he's in this vision.
Yeah, maybe.
And then she goes to the vision.
Mm-hmm.
So either way, it's a big tell on her power.
Yeah. She also says those people lie about their food, talking about the people in Yadaa, yeah. because she was trying to eat all 10 pancakes of the festival of pancakes, and there ended up only being really nine.
Nine.
And so she's saying they lied about their food.
The most important thing to comment on,
right.
of course.
It's so funny.
The Stormfather's not having it. This is not possible.
Yeah.
How did she come here? You didn't bring her in, Dalinar said softly. No, this is not possible. How? Yanagon finally attained the top of the boulder and gave the younger girl a hug. She had long dark hair, pale white eyes, and tan skin, though she likely wasn't a Lethi. Face was a little too round. Reshi, perhaps. He's trying to convince me I should trust him, Yanagon says. Don't, she said. He's got too nice a butt. So Lif's instinct is don't trust Dalinar.
Don't trust him. Look at his butt.
Don't trust him. He's got one of those butts.
He's got one of those untrustworthy butts.
Yeah. He's got a butt that I just don't trust.
Yeah.
Dalinar cleared his throat. What? Well, your butt is too nice. Old guys shouldn't have tight butts. It means you spend way too much time swinging a sword around or punching people. You should have like an old flabby butt. Then I trust you. Yanagon says she has a thing about butts. No, I don't, the girl says, rolling her eyes. If someone thinks I'm strange for talking about butts, it's usually because they're jealous, because I'm like the only one without something rammed up mine. She says, let's go.
Let's go. Let's get out of here. Yeah.
I love Lif. How can you not? There are people out there that don't like her, right?
I think so,
in terms of the community.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Come on. How can you not love Lif?
She's so awesome.
Come on.
Yeah, she's fun.
But, Dalinar says, raising his hand. See, you're
learning.
She grins. I love this. You know what I love? He's being dismissed by kids.
He's frazzled right now. He's like, what the hell? What's happening?
Yeah.
Stormfather's like, this is not possible.
Yeah. And,
yeah, look at your butt. Like, it's just completely,
oh my God.
Yeah, complete craziness.
Then she and the Emperor vanished. The Stormfather rumbled in frustration. That woman, this is a creation specifically meant to defy my will. Woman? Dalinar asks. That child is tainted by the Night Watcher. Well, technically, so am I.
Right.
This is different. This is unnatural. She goes too far. The Stormfather rumbled his discontent, refusing to speak to Dalinar any further. He seemed genuinely upset. In fact, Dalinar was forced to sit and wait until the vision finished. He spent that time staring out over the field of the dead, haunted equally by the future and the past.
So the Stormfather is implying that Lif's connection with the Night Watcher is the reason why she was able to get in without him bringing her in.
Right.
Which is really interesting.
So hang on. So does that mean that potentially she also has had, or she's had an experience with the old magic? Right?
We know that for sure. That's how she can eat food and turn it into Stormlight.
Oh yeah, that's true too.
Right.
Yeah. It's crazy. Yeah. I love Lif's. I like that she just, you know what she's a bit like in a way?
Mm.
Like a childlike Deadpool.
For sure.
She just shows up.
Stream like, of consciousness.
It would not surprise me in the least if you could write that character to break the fourth wall.
Yeah. She'd like literally look at the camera.
Yeah. Or like just in the pages, like,
yeah,
just somehow like speak to you as the reader. Like, I don't know.
Hey, it you.
Just
yeah, seems... you reading this book right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so bizarre.
Yeah. It would. If any character would, it would be her or like
it'd be her.
Or Wit or something, you know?
Or Wit. Yeah. Wit would be cool. Oh, so Wit was my original thought for the one that he thought was familiar.
Mm-hmm. Well, the reason why he was familiar, like we just found out, was because
was the herald.
Yeah, and he's seen like images of this herald so many times in their religion that.
Right. But I'm just telling you, like when I was first reading
it,
I thought Wit you know, Shallan, someone with that kind of power to become someone else in disguise.
It would have meant that that person was there thousands of years ago when it actually, when the vision actually happened, or that they were in the vision and had made themselves look different.
Well, what about, even to make it more complicated, what if someone can go in a vision and be a herald? And then, so what Dalinar is experiencing is he thinks it's this herald, but what if it's not?
Right.
Like, what's to say it isn't another actor, another someone inhabiting another role?
That's possible. I think that it is the herald, because Yonagon's also recognized him as being, because they, their like main deity is Yezrian.
Right.
Like Azir is actually from the name Yezir, which is what they call him. So I think that the both of them having recognized him makes it more, you know.
Yeah. Corroborates it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great chapter. Highlight. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Lift.
Come on. It's, the butts.
The butts. For some people reading it, it might be, you know, like, I could sort of see how it might not be.
It takes away from some of the seriousness or whatever.
It does, but that the interjection of levity is, I think, the playful spirit of this series.
Yeah, I love it.
And this series is striving for its own tone. It doesn't really need to be so mired in seriousness like other series like Dune, or certainly of Game of Thrones.
Mm-hmm.
It's its own thing. And so I find that characters like Lift are integral, I think, to what Mr. Sanderson is doing here, personally. But
one of the things I my highlight for this is that I have more of an understanding of what's going on in the script here because I read Edgedancer, which I hadn't read before.
Right.
So knowing that she's back from Yadaw and what that means and the food and all that stuff, I didn't know that the first few times I read this book because I had never read the novellas, right?
Right.
So I like that. That's my highlight.
That's super
a little deeper understanding.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Cool.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Well, we still have one more to go.
Yes. One more. Let's do this.
Chapter 43. And this is titled Spearmen.
Yeah.
Whew. So we get that awesome image here of the shoulder without the patch and the sort of broken ridge around it. It begins with, "You have spoken to one who cannot respond. We instead will take your communication to us, though we know not how you located us upon this world." Another cryptic message.
Very strange.
"You have spoken to one who cannot respond. We, instead, will take your communication to us, though we know not how you located us upon this world."
Yeah, very strange. It's hard to decipher what it means with the larger...
Yeah, I don't have a guess right now, I'm afraid, so we'll just have to jump into the text.
Yeah.
"Moash picked at the mush that Faberth called a stew, and it tasted like creme." Well, my first thought is good. I'm glad it tastes like creme, because Moash, you're a bridgeman and you should have known better than to fall into this allegiance with this idealized, this idealized, I guess, vision for the future of the world, which included killing Elokar.
Right.
It's just
this conspiracy.
But it's hard. But it must be hard. Like once you've bought into something like that.
Mm-hmm.
How do you undo it?
Yeah, and you know, it's funny because it makes me think of some other circumstances that are going on. And how do you, once you pick a side for something, how hard is it to, if you're having second thoughts, how hard is it to get out because you've like kind of doubled down on it so many times? It must be really hard to pull away, you know?
I think so.
Did you ever think we were going to learn about Moash? Like, did you expect this?
No, I didn't expect it. I figured there would be further chapters about him.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't expecting it right now.
Right.
I'm glad that we do have a little bit here. Although it's curious because Moash is presented with an interesting opportunity here.
Mm-hmm.
He could be the bridgeman within.
What
like
do you mean?
He has
within,
an opp-
oh, within this other organization?
Within the Voidbringers, yeah.
Within the Voidbringers?
Like, well, he's with them now, isn't he? Isn't he not?
Oh, at the very end, he ends up being taken by them, yeah.
Right.
Right.
Right. And if he plays the game...
It's a little bit of a reverse. It's a little bit following what happened to Kaladin, too.
Yes. So. Yeah, it is.
Mm-hmm.
But... Hang on. But they had red eyes. Yeah. So they were in. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So these are, and these guys were, like flew in. These are the fused.
They flew in. Yeah. Right. So these are the fused. Yeah. Exactly.
Whereas
so,
Kaladin got brought into a group of
Parshendi.
Parshmen who were newly freed of their
newly
like dull slave form.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things I want to point out here before we move on is at the beginning of part two, it listed all the different POVs that we would experience in this part. It was Shallan, Yasna, Dalinar, and Bridge 4.
Right.
And I think it's very telling that Sanderson still considers Moash
a part,
of Bridge 4.
Yeah.
Even if Moash doesn't consider himself part of it still. Like, I know that's like looking
earlier,
at it a little more meta or whatever, but... I like the idea that this is a... Because if he was not part of Bridge 4, it would have said Moash as well. But by not saying Moash, you keep it a surprise that Moash is coming up. But also, you're also including him in the Sigzil and Rock and Tef chapters that we've had of Bridge 4 members. So I think that's an important distinction there.
Well, that's what I say, like, with regards to at the end of the chapter. He has an opportunity to... be a force within the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah,
you know,
it's an opportunity
could,
for sure.
There could be something really great happen from Moash on the opposite side when Kaladin and the others need it the most.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Moash, he stared at the flamespren in their large cook fire, trying to warm himself as Faberth, a Thalen man, with striking horn-eater red hair, argued with Graves. The fire's smoke curled into the air, and the light would be visible for miles across the Frostlands. But Graves didn't care. He figured that if the Everstorm hadn't cleared the bandits out of the area, two Shardbearers would be more than enough to deal with any who remained.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty logical...
For sure.
...way of thinking, but you're not accounting for these... For these fused.
Right. We don't know. This is something brand new, right? The fused are something new.
Shardblades can't stop an arrow in the back. I like that in these three chapters with regards to the arrow, like Dalinar was commenting that, you know, his proficiency with the bow is not great.
Mm-hmm.
But I also like this Shardblades can't stop an arrow in the back.
Mm-hmm.
Moash thought, feeling exposed. And neither can plate, if we're not wearing it.
Right,
his
which
armor
not.
And that of Graves were bundled in the wagon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Look, that is the triplets, Graves said, waving toward a rock formation. It's right here on the map. We go west now. I've been this way before, Faberth says. We must continue south, you see. Then east. The map. I have no need for your maps, Faberth says, folding his arms. The passions guide me. The passions, Graves says. The passions? You're supposed to have abandoned those superstitions. You belong to the diagram now. I can do both, Faberth said solemnly. Moash stuffed another spoonful of stew into his mouth. Stew is in quotations.
Mm-hmm.
Storms, he hated it when Faberth took a turn cooking and when Graves took a turn and when Fia took a turn. And even he admits that he's not much of a cook. None of them could cook worth a done ship, not like Rock.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting how he, you know, you never know what you're missing until you lose it, right?
Mm-hmm. It's also a little interesting that in just two chapters ago, Teft was given the bowl of stew and couldn't eat it.
Right.
And now Moash physically can't
eat
it because he's not with it anymore, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Moash dropped his bowl. letting the mush slop over the side, and stalked out into the night. He hated how cold it was down here. Perpetual winter. The four of them had suffered through the storms, hiding in the cramped, reinforced bottom of their wagon, which they'd chained to the ground. But that new storm. Moash kicked a rock, but it was frozen to the ground. He stubbed his toe. He cursed. He'd once admired how refined Graves had been. The man's patience, though, had frayed to threads, and his refinement didn't matter much when they were all eating slop and pissing behind hills. This is an interesting observation, I find, is that you can be caught up with something, mm-hmm. convinced that you need to kill Elokar. Graves is an important person in your life. You mm-hmm. revere this person. Mm-hmm. And then circumstances change. And then that perspective changes.
Yeah.
On that person.
And
that
now you're
person
like,
no
what
longer.
The fuck?
Yeah. And now you're like, what the hell am I doing?
Yeah.
I'm in the Frostlands. I'm following Graves. Mm-hmm. Why? Mm-hmm. Like you have the potential to see things differently now.
Yeah.
And this really speaks to, I don't know. For me, it's this idea of the plurality of truth. You know, it's fleeting, it's momentary.
Yeah.
It's situational. Mm-hmm. And it certainly isn't absolute.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. Sanderson does a really good job of bringing back themes that he's used before, right? And
yeah.
In the Way of Kings, there's a moment there when they're on the plateau, they're on the Shattered Plains, and they have a choice between freedom and honor. Do they go back right. to the tower and help the Kolinars, the Kolins, save them, help them try to yeah. survive? Or
right.
do they run across the Frostlands and seek freedom? Well,
seek freedom,
they
yeah.
chose honor.
Right.
But then Moash ends up not choosing honor a second time, and he ends right. up running away for his life on the Frostlands.
Right. And here he is.
Yeah. And he's in the situation that the men would have been in had they chosen the other way.
Right.
In this cold, horrible environment, running for their lives, trying to stay alive, lost in this perpetual winter area. It's mm-hmm. quite hilarious and fitting that it ended up this way. You know, because originally Moash was part of the group that didn't choose this, but they ended up choosing this. He ended up here anyways.
Ended up here anyway. What if Kaladin and the rest had walked away?
Right. Well, that's a whole if storyline we've talked about before. Like, if they would, as a troop, as a squad, they would have left?
Yeah.
Right.
They left. And what if they did go to the Frostlands? Mm-hmm. What if these fused came upon Kaladin and his crew?
It's tricky because they would have been far gone by then because it took,
right.
you know, the fuse, the Everstorm, all that stuff to happen
True.
Before they, so they, you know, who knows?
Who knows? That's a what if. Okay. Not like rock, right? Perpetual winter, but that new storm, he kicks the rock, he's eating slop, he's looking at Graves differently now, seeing him differently. How lost are we? Moash asks. We're not lost at all if that idiot would actually look at the map. I've told you to get rid of that coat. Glancing at Moash, which I'll do when we're not crawling across winter's own frozen backside. At least take off the patch. It might give us away. If we meet someone from the war camps, just rip it off. Graves turned on his heel and walked back toward the camp. Moash felt at the Bridge 4 patch on his shoulder. It brought memories. Joining Graves and his band, who had been planning to kill King Elokar, an assassination attempt once Dalinar was away, marching toward the center of the Shattered Plains, facing off against Kaladin, wounded and bleeding. You will not have him. Moash's skin had gone clammy from the cold. He slid his knife from his side sheath. He still wasn't used to being able to carry one that long. A knife that was too big could get you into trouble as a Dark Eyes. But he wasn't Dark Eyed anymore. He was one of them. And he cut the stitches on the Bridge 4 patch, up one side and down the other. How simple it was. It would be harder to remove the tattoo he'd gotten with the others, but that he'd placed on his shoulder, not his forehead.
Mm-hmm.
Moash held up the patch, trying to catch the firelight for a last look, and then couldn't bring himself to throw it away. He walked back and settled by the fire. Were the others sitting around Rock's stew pot somewhere, laughing and joking, betting on how many mugs of ale Lopin could drink, or ribbing Kaladin, trying to get him to crack a smile? Moash could almost hear their voices, and he smiled, imagining that he was there. Then he imagined Kaladin telling them what Moash had done. "He tried to kill me. He betrayed everything, his oath to protect the king, his duty to Alethkar, but most importantly to us." And Moash sagged, patch in his fingers. He should throw that thing in the fire. He should throw himself in the fire.
Mm-hmm.
Just like Tef should throw himself in the well.
Yeah. Some regrets here.
He looked up toward the skies, towards...
It's funny, I just want to make a comment that Moash is assuming that Kaladin has told all the men what Moash has done,
he hasn't
told them anything.
No, I know.
It shows that Moash doesn't really know Kaladin as much as he thinks he knows him.
No.
You know what I mean?
Exactly, that's true, yep. He's catastrophizing, and I totally identify with this in a very close and personal way.
Mm-hmm.
He should throw himself into the fire. He looked up toward the skies, toward damnation and the tranquiline halls. A group of star spren quivered above, and beside them, something moved in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
I love how this chapter gets to this point.
Did you think it was going to be the fused first, or did you think it was going to be Bridge 4?
I thought it was going to be some event, a spren. Some intervention moment.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't anticipating this.
Right.
But I'm so glad that it happened. And I'm so glad that by the end of this page, this whole trajectory for Moash is completely and irrevocably changed in a few sentences.
Mm-hmm.
Look up in the sky. Moash shouted as four Voidbringers descended upon the little camp. They smashed into the ground, wielding long, sinuous swords, not shard blades. Those were Parshendi weapons. One creature struck where Moash had been sitting an instant before. Another creature stabbed at Graves straight through the chest and then yanked the weapon free and beheaded him with a backhand swipe.
Mm-hmm.
Graves is dead.
Yeah, that's how quick it was, bro.
Right there.
Yeah.
I know, it's amazing. Graves's corpse tumbled and his shard blade materialized, clanging to the ground. Fiberth and Fia didn't have a chance. Other Voidbringers struck them down, spilling their blood in this cold, forgotten land. The fourth Voidbringer came for Moash, who threw himself into a roll. The creature's sword slammed down near him, hitting the rock, the blade throwing sparks. Moash rolled to his feet, and Kaladin's training, drilled into him from hours and hours spent at the bottom of a chasm, took over.
Mm-hmm.
He danced away, putting his back to the wagon as his shard blade fell into his fingers. Dude, that Kaladin is with him?
Yeah.
You cannot have him.
Yeah.
You cannot have him. It's the training is everything.
Yeah. It's all in there.
Discipline is destiny.
Mm-hmm.
He trained, therefore he has the ability now, in this moment, to deal with this.
Yeah, it's awesome. With
this situation.
Mm-hmm.
Kaladin has saved him.
Yeah, you're right. Again.
Yet again.
Yeah.
Yes, 100%. The Voidbringer rounded the fire toward him, light glittering from her taut, muscular body. These weren't like the Parshendi that he'd seen on the Shattered Plains. They had deep red eyes and red-violet carapace, some of which framed their faces. The one facing him had a swirling pattern to her skin, three different colors mixing, red, black, and white. Dark light, like inverse stormlight, clung to each of them. Graves had spoken of these creatures, calling their return merely one of many events predicted by the inscrutable diagram.
Mm-hmm.
Moash's foe came for him, and he lashed out. That's so funny. Where's your diagram now, Graves?
Right. Done.
Yeah. Moash's foe came for him and lashed out with his blade, driving her back. She seemed to glide as she moved, feet barely touching the ground. I love this. Mm-hmm. Their ability to fly, and just the description of this. When he gets her, when he does a maneuver where he slams her to the ground,
yeah,
and she doesn't hit the ground.
Yeah, she just...
She hovers.
Yeah.
Oh, dude. Do you know how badly I want to see that?
Yeah, like, that's awesome.
I can see it in my mind's eye for sure, but... Okay, she seemed to glide as she moved, feet barely touching the ground. The other three ignored him, instead picking through the camp, inspecting the bodies. One sword. So that's funny. So they're very confident that mm-hmm. she can handle.
Yep. They're not even going to back her up. Yeah.
So they go right to the DM saying, okay, I loot the bodies.
Yeah, right.
I want to find out what's here.
That's funny.
It's so funny. One sword in a graceful leap onto the wagon and began digging in the items there. His motion seemed clumsy compared to the graceful power of this creature that he was up against.
Mm-hmm.
I love. It's like they're dancing.
Yeah.
Right? And she's just so elegant. Her clothing rippling in the wind, breath visible in the cold air. Oh, I love picturing this. This weapon was just too clunky, he's thinking. 6 feet long, it was hard to angle right. It could cut through anything, but he needed to actually hit for that to matter, and it had been much easier to wield this thing wearing plate.
Mm-hmm.
Without wearing that plate armor, he felt like a child holding an adult's weapon. The Voidbringer smiled.
Mm-hmm.
Then she struck with blurring speed. He took a long cut up the arm, but his move prevented her from impaling him. His arm flared with pain, and he grunted. The Voidbringer regarded him confidently. He was dead. And maybe he should simply let it happen. The Voidbringer, working in the cart, said something eager, excited. He had found the shard plate. He kicked other items while digging it free, and something rolled out of the pack of the wagon, thumping against the stone. A spear. Moash looked down at his shard blade, the wealth of nations, the most powerful possession that a man could own. Who am I kidding, he thought. Who did I ever think I was kidding? Oh, dude. Highlight, right?
Yeah.
Dude, it's amazing. The spear dropping.
Yeah.
Got the most powerful weapon
in my hands. A reminder of who he really is.
Who am I kidding?
Yeah, like, I'm not a shard bearer. I'm not a light eyes.
Right.
I'm a dark-eyed spearman. Yeah. Part of Bridge 4.
I'm Bridge 4.
Yeah.
Right. The Voidbringer woman launched into an attack, but Moash dismissed the shard blade and dashed away, which gave him time to dive for the spear, rolling to his feet. Holding the smooth wood in his hand, a familiar weight, Moash snapped into stance. The air suddenly smelled damp and faintly rotten. He remembered the chasms, life and death together, vines and rot. Oh, I love that.
It's so cool. I just love how all of this stuff is just coming back to him, right? Like,
he could hear Kaladin's voice. You can't fear a shard blade. You can't fear a light eyes on horseback. They kill with fear first, and the sword second. Stand your ground. The Voidbringer came for him, and Moash stood his ground. The Voidbringer gasped in surprise as Moash executed a takedown that he'd practiced 1,000 times
mm-hmm.
in the chasms. He swept her legs out from under her, and then began to follow with a classic thrust and stab down, but unfortunately the Voidbringer didn't fall. She caught herself in the air, hovering instead of collapsing. The Voidbringer glided backward. She then leaped forward and grabbed Moash's spear as he tried to use it to ward her off. She gracefully pulled herself close to him, inside his reach, and she smelled of wet clothing and of the alien, moldy scent he associated with the Parshendi.
Mm-hmm.
She pressed her hand against Moash's chest, and that dark light transferred from her to him, and Moash felt himself grow lighter. So what do you think's happened here?
She's using a lashing on him. She pressed her hand against Moas's chest, and that dark light transferred from her to him.
And so Moash he can't get away? Is that what she did?
She's like lashing him. She's like making him float or whatever. But fortunately, Kaladin had tried this on him too. He's got experience fighting against this. It's awesome.
Moash sees the Voidbringer with one hand, holding onto the front of the loose shirt as the body tried to fall into the air. He yanked her upward with him, with one hand while pushing his spear head down against the rocky ground. That sent the two of them spinning in the air, hovering. She cried out in an alien tongue. Moash dropped his spear and grabbed his knife. She tried to shove him away, lashing him again, stronger this time, and he grunted but hung on and got his knife up and rammed it into her chest. Orange Parshendi blood poured around his hand, spraying into the cold night as they continued to spin in the air, and Moash hung on, pushed the knife farther. She didn't heal as Kaladin would have. Her eyes stopped glowing and the dark light vanished. The body grew limp, and he dropped the 5 feet to the ground with her body cushioning the fall. Orange blood coated him, steaming in the chill air. He seized his spear again, fingers slick with blood, and pointed it at the three remaining Voidbringers. Bridge four, you bastards. You can probably kill me, but I'll take one of you with me. At least one. They didn't seem angry that they had that he had killed their friend. Storms, though, did things like these even have emotions? Shen had often just sat around staring. He locked eyes with the woman at the center. Her skin was white and red, not a bit of black in it. The paleness of that white reminded him of the Shin, who always looked sickly to Moash. "You," she said, "have passion." One of the others handed her Graves' shard blade, and she held it up. Then she rose into the air. "You may choose. Die here, or accept defeat and give up your weapons." Moash clung to the spear in the shadow of that figure, her clothing rippling in the air. Did they think he'd actually trust them? Did he really think he could stand against three of them? With a shrug, he tossed aside the spear and he summoned his blade. After all those years dreaming of one of these, he'd finally received one. Kaladin had given it to him. And what good had come of it? He obviously couldn't be trusted with such a weapon. Setting his jaw, Moash pressed his hand to the gemstone and willed the bond to break. The gemstone, as at its pommel, flashed, and he felt an icy coolness wash through him. Back to being a Dark Eyes. What do you think's transpiring there?
Well, he has to give up his weapon. Everything he thought he wanted, he got.
Right.
And it wasn't what he needed.
No.
Right? He said, "I can't fight with this sword. It's too clumsy without the blade.
Without the plate.
Or the plate." Yeah. What he really needed was just a stick and a point, like a spear.
Yeah.
So I think it's showing him who he really is.
He tossed the blade to the ground. One of the Voidbringers took it. Another flew off, and Moash was confused as to what was happening. A short time later, that one returned with six more. Three of them attached ropes to the shard plate bundles and flew off, hauling the heavy armor into the air after them. Why not lash it, he thought. Moash thought for a moment they were actually going to leave him there, but finally two others grabbed him, one arm each, and hauled him into the air.
Whew. So he gets to live.
He's
captive.
He's captive.
Mm-hmm. Much like Kaladin, right? I think that it's the fact that it's mirroring what happened with Kaladin, even slightly, is kind of interesting.
Yeah, you mean Kaladin's journey when he left with the Parshendi.
Yeah, and he was.
Yeah.
But the thing is that Kaladin seeing them as people, and Moash here is being captive by. Like the true bad guys, the true void bringers here.
Right, the fused.
You know what I mean? Like
yeah.
These fused, yeah. So
it's different that way. And
I guess, pardon me, what do you think? Is Moash here going to remain a bridge four within these numbers? Or is he going to join them?
We don't know. It could be either way. Like this, during this whole fight, all of his training from bridge four came back. So he obviously still holds all that stuff really close to him.
Yeah.
So we don't know.
It's really great. I mean, highlight for me is the spear.
Mm-hmm.
Denying the blade, can't use it anyway. Him realizing that.
Who was I really anyways? Who did I think I was?
Right.
Yeah.
Who am I kidding?
Mm-hmm.
Who am I kidding? And in a few seconds, the diagram is broken.
Yeah.
Graves. What was the other character's name?
For birth.
And Fia.
Yeah.
All dead. Everything that he had thought was important.
Yeah, it's all gone.
And followed. It's over.
Mm-hmm.
So now what?
Yeah.
So great.
My highlight is just a tiny little part here when he says, orange Parshendi blood poured around his hands, spraying into the cold night as they continued to spin in the air.
Right.
She didn't heal as Kaladin would have.
Right.
I don't think I noticed this before. Now I'm starting to think, do these fused even have the ability to heal? If they would have, she would have, right? She would have. So that means
if they could have lashed it, then they would have lashed it.
It makes sense for the fuse to not need healing because they have another vessel waiting for them.
Right.
Right. Unlimited. The real personality in this body is just the Spren and the gem heart. And so you kill it. It goes back into the storm, into the Everstorm, and will be reborn again soon afterwards in 9 days or whenever the next Everstorm comes by. So they don't have need of healing because they have an endless supply of bodies.
Right.
Whereas the Radiants, they don't. They have to be able to heal themselves from their wounds because it is only them.
Right.
It's interesting. It's an interesting little like thing that's in there that, you know, it's like the difference in character classes or in races or whatever in the book or whatever. You know what I mean? Like,
and that speaks to Yasna's point too.
Yeah.
Cut off their supply.
Right. It makes sense, even though it's brutal and horrible. It does make sense.
It's cold, but I'm just waiting for the fusing, whatever you want to call it. I'm waiting for that process to happen to someone other than the Parshendi.
Like a Voidbringer? Or a Parshendi, yeah. Or a Parshman.
Yeah. Or a Parshman, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting, eh?
That I think is something
that's coming.
Could be to come. Could be. Because there isn't, from what we've read and covered, there isn't an explanation that would claim a particular relationship, if you will, to the Parshman and the Parshendi having to be affected by this Everstorm.
Right.
So
we know that the Parshman or the listeners have a unique physiology that allows them to be able to take on new forms.
That is true. Yeah.
Right.
That is true.
So, but there's no reason to think that it can't happen to other beings on this planet. So, I guess it's something that we'll look forward to. Something else that we can look forward to is Buzzkill's info dump.
We have to get that. Will on the werewolf. Will on the
Discord.
On the movie night
on
the movie night on Friday. Which, of course, by the way, please feel free to drop by for these movie nights that we do, where we basically do what we're doing here on the Storm Pod.
Mm-hmm.
And dissect a movie of our choice whenever we can pop on.
Mm-hmm.
So Will was able to get the Fabricland
jingle
and repeat it, which is hilarious. I wasn't expecting it, and he was able to do it multiple times. And then you popped on for a second. But so info dump. Let's do it.
It's definitely a lawsuit waiting to happen. So in chapter 41, On the Ground Looking Up, we get the name of something here. A woman with pale white skin glowing faintly and hair that hovered around her head like clouds. We don't have the name in this chapter, but this sounds like it could be Tef's Spren.
Yeah.
Like maybe his version of Syl or Pattern. And we think that maybe he may have said more than one oath, because she did say, "You said oaths." So, very interesting. We learn much more about fire moss. You grind it between your thumb and forefinger. The moss lets off a small plume of smoke, and in the dim light, the center of the moss glows like an ember. It actually like burns your fingers, and you have to grow calluses in order not to burn. For Teft anyways, it washes away his pains, and it strengthens his resolve. He could remember long ago that fire moss had done to him, and he remembered euphoria, nights spent in a dizzy, wonderful daze. These days, he needed it just to feel normal. So very similar to some other harsh drugs that we have in our world. So, I like that he's equated it to some, it sounds like fire moss is pretty brutal though. Chapter 42, Consequences. Safix is a city in northeast Azir. They say Safix was filled with bones blown by the high storms into piles as tall as buildings. So that's from the days of the Sunmaker conquering. So Safix is another city there. Tubela was mentioned, a country located in central Roshar, bordering the Pure Lake in northeast of Urthiru. This is also a place where Tin was raised, if you remember that character from Words of Radiance.
I do. I didn't remember that she was raised there.
It's Tubela is filled with nomadic tribes, so they're more... We get Yezrian, the king of the heralds, also known as Yezereza Ellen. I like to hear that he's like, wait, do the king of the heralds have dark eyes? So so ingrained in their biases, the Alethi. We get the name of the Day of Glory, which is also the Arhaitium, which people thought was the end of the world. We noticed in that chapter there was a spot here where there might have been the sleepless corpses. One spot they passed had a whole heap of strange kremlings burned and smoking. Who would have taken time to pile up 1,000 little crustaceans? So clearly that has to do with one of those these beings that we met in Edge Dancer, which is awesome because there's another, that's almost like the foreshadowing to Lyft coming in, because we met that character in Edge Dancer and then now Lyft comes in at the end. So it's kind of a nice little foreshadowing there. And then chapter 43, Spearmen, we meet Firbirth and Fia, which are people that are obviously part of the diagram. One is a bad cook and one is a worse cook, according to Moash, which is really funny. The triplets is a rock formation in the Frostlands. And then there's mention of the fused swords. They smashed into the ground wielding long, sinuous swords, not shard blades. Yeah. Those were Parshendi weapons. So really, really interesting. Moash also notices the void light. Her eyes stopped glowing and the dark light vanished. So we've talked about that before, this void light, this dark light that they the fused use. It's different from the storm light. Yeah, and that's it. That's it for the episode, everyone. Thank you again to Buzzkill Joe for doing the info dump, for doing all the hard work and letting me get the glory. If you want to be part of the Patreon team, you can go to patreon.com/heroesof. We would normally read a list of patrons right now, but we are running a little late on our recording, so Jack and I will just say quick goodbyes here. If you want to be part of the Patreon team, you can do so at patreon.com/heroesof. I know I just said that, but I'm going to say it again because hopefully you'll remember it. If you want to reach out to us and talk to us, you can do so at heroesofacathra@gmail.com. You can hook up with us on Twitter at heroesofone, on Instagram at the Storm Pod, or make sure that you join up the subreddit, the Storm Pod, and the Facebook page, the Storm Pod. You want to say a little something for next episode?
Well, what are we covering?
We are doing two chapters, chapter 44 and chapter 45. Chapter 44 is a little bit longer of a chapter, and then chapter 45 is a shorter of a chapter. So, it'll be very interesting. We will do that next episode. Everyone, thank you very much for listening to the episode. We love you very much. Until next time.
Take care, everybody.
The Storm Pod is brought to you by Heroes of. Music and theme song by Jack Forrest Productions. Additional music by Jason Moray. Produced by our wonderful Patreon team and the Heroes of Akathra.